Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. An incredible four-decade account of murder, power, and corruption in one of the country's largest police departments. In 1979, the gruesome slaying of a 13-year-old boy riveted the suburbs of Suffolk County, New York. As the county hustled to bring the case to a dubious resolution, a wayward local teenager emerged with a convenient story to tell. For his cooperation, Jimmy Burke was rewarded with a job as a cop. Thus began Burke's unlikely ascent to the top of one of the country's largest law enforcement jurisdictions. He and a crew of like-minded allies utilized vengeance, gangster tactics, and political leverage to become the most powerful and feared figures in their suburban empire. Until a pilfered bag of sex toys brought it all crashing down. Jimmy the King is the story of the rise, reign, and paranoid fall of a corrupt cop and his regime, a crime family with badges and guaranteed pensions. Novelistic in detail and piercing in its political insight, this book will leave you questioning who modern policing serves, who it protects, and who it preys upon and abandons. The book that we're featuring this evening is Jimmy the King, Murder, Vice, and the Reign of a Dirty Cop, with my special guest journalist and author, Gus Garcia Roberts. Welcome to the program and thank you for this interview, Gus Garcia Roberts.
Thanks for having me on. Very excited.
Thank you so much and for this incredible book and this interview. Let's start off, because there's so much to cover, right with the center of this story, how it all began in 1979 with Johnny Pius, a 13-year-old. Tell us what happens April 20th, 1979.
Sure. So in Smithtown, New York, which is a suburb about 40 to 50 miles east of New York City, the body of a 13-year-old boy was discovered behind a schoolyard in suburbia out there. And that was John Pius. And police found six small stones stuffed down his throat. And he had been badly beaten. And so it sort of created like this existential crisis in these young suburbs, which 20 years previous had been potato farmland to find out who did it and make them accountable.
So right away, Suffolk County is called and their detectives assigned to this. What happens right from the very beginning of this investigation? How does it proceed?
Well, so one of the first things that the detectives noticed Pius's body was that he had an imprint on his face that they called it a Greek cross, and it essentially was a design that was clearly from the bottom of a footprint, as in one of his killers or his killer had apparently stomped on his face with a sneaker that was distinctly of the Puma brand. And so, you know, the homicide detectives of Suffolk County for decades before this and for years after this were sort of like a unique tribe, you know, as I learned in reporting this book, in that, you know, they relied almost purely on their sort of hunches and instinct, and the way that they closed cases, with very little exception, was by getting confessions. You know, they had very little use, for example, for forensics. So from the very beginning, these detectives seized on the idea that this kid had a Puma imprint on his face, which to them meant that it had been other kids who had done this because, you know, children wore Puma sneakers. And so the way that they went about trying to solve this case was by essentially at random dragging teenagers, former classmates of John Pius, and slightly older kids, almost all of them minors though, dragging them off the street and into interrogation rooms and lying to their parents about where they were and not allowing the kids to have access to lawyers and interrogating them. And the goal was pretty simple. Interrogate them until they confessed. And during one of these interrogation sessions, one boy did confess. His name was Peter Carterero. And, you know, like others, he had been separated from his parents. He and a couple of other friends had been locked in the precinct for hours at end. And the parents were concerned that there had been another killing because they couldn't find their kids. And cops had told them that they didn't know where the kids were. And at one point, Peter Carterero, who really was sort of the least likely suspect, one of the least likely suspects among this group in Smithtown, to commit a murder. He was literally a Boy Scout who had never been in trouble before. Eventually, police drive him to the scene of the crime, and he confesses in the backseat of their car, and he implicates three of his friends, his brother and two friends. And the confession is tape recorded. And what he later claimed is that the detectives, before they, you know, started the tape recorder, told him exactly what to say. So he implicates himself and three other friends in the murder of John Pius.
Now, you detail the techniques that the homicide squad utilizes in this investigation. And you also talk about the prosecution's role in this early on. Tell us about the prosecution's role early on, if that was typical or not, and what about witnesses?
Right. So typically the prosecutors, you know, this county would get involved once there was an arrest and charges. But I think because this case kind of had such seismic importance to the residents of Suffolk County, and it was, you know, covered with like screaming headlines and Newsday, the local newspaper. And at one point, the DA's office apparently decided, you know, we need to get involved earlier. Yeah, and you know, a sort of determination to get charges as quickly as possible sort of came about. And so the prosecutor who handled the case and he went to the precinct the night that that Peter Carterero and his friends were being interrogated was a guy named Tom Spoda. And so Spoda sort of, you know, he listened to Peter Carterero's confession on tape after it was done. And by his own account, he was sort of underwhelmed. One, the confession did not really at all match the facts of the crime scene. And in fact, you know, it contradicted it in pretty key ways. One of them, for example, was Peter Carterero said in the confession that his brother Mike, during the attack on John Pius, and his brother Mike put Pius's bicycle up against a tree behind the schoolyard. But the fact of the crime scene was that Mike was actually on the ground when bystanders first discovered the body. And it was later placed up against a tree by one of those bystanders who discovered the body. And then when police arrived, when certain detectives arrived, they saw that the bike was up against the tree. But in fact, you know, this sort of unrefuted court testimony that it was not. So what you had several examples of that were sort of like a tell embedded in the confession and embedded in other statements that would come out that sort of that cast serious doubt in those statements and, you know, kind of begged the question, were these facts planted by the text? So anyway, so Spoda sort of knew that he had a problem here and that, for one, you know, there's these contradictions and, you know, even more primarily, Peter Cordero was 15 years old and he was in a detective's car and being interrogated without lawyer or parent, which was illegal under New York state law. So, you know, most likely, as would eventually end up happening, the confession would be tossed. So what Spoda needed was sort of like his hallmark, his style of prosecution, which was witnesses who were later privy to supposed confessions. So he sort of started putting out feelers among all of the wayward kids of Smithtown, looking for those who might have a story about one of these four kids confessing to them later. And so this process took months, and in the book, I sort of compare it to the mobsters, you know, gathering together, pretending like nothing is wrong, where in reality, they're sort of wondering who's going to snitch on the other to the feds. So you have all the sort of kids of Smithtown, typically those who, you know, were juvenile delinquents, had been in some trouble before. And, you know, they're gathering in that summer following the murder, gathering in bleachers or in fields and, you know, hanging out. But there's an undertone to it because some of these kids are attempting to get statements implicating the others and bring them to the prosecutor's office. And that's eventually what happens. And so one witness among a crew of burglars and drug users who were in Smithtown emerges as the most solid witness in this case. And a guy who sort of, you know, outlives the taped confession and outlasts the other witnesses in the case, and that guy is the main character, for lack of a better term, of the book, who is Jimmy Burke.
You say born James Charles Burke in October 1964, but his father's in law enforcement and his grandfather as well. Tell us a little bit about the background of James Charles Burke.
Sure. So he was originally from, you know, like so many characters in this book, and if you're familiar with Long Island, this won't be surprising because there's sort of a pipeline from the outer boroughs to Nassau, and particularly Suffolk County, as you know, city dwellers kind of gain upward mobility and move out to the burbs. So he was from Ozone Park, Queens, which was a very tough neighborhood, home to the Gambino crime family. And, you know, my reporting is as a younger kid, he was actually extremely smart and actually quite a good student. And a dutiful student at a Catholic school there. He had moved to Smithtown shortly before the murder, and that appeared to sort of really change his personality. It was following a divorce between his parents and his mom had remarried. And he sort of immediately kind of fell in with this crew of kids that, you know, their peers derided them as pit people because they hung out in an area behind Smithtown High School East that was referred to as the pit. And it's typically where people smoke cigarettes, and the kids, you know, who hung out there were often truants and drug users. And Jimmy sort of proudly proclaimed that he was a drug user, and he hung out with a crew of kids who were known to be Smithtown's, you know, leading burglars, so much so that, you know, they tracked the price of gold, and they would sort of go through people's unlocked doors because in Smithtown they didn't really lock their doors because they felt so comfortable in suburbia. Go through people's unlocked doors and rifle through jewelry boxes and come out with gold and pawn them off. And so that's who James Burke was at the time that he emerged as Spoda's sort of key witness. He was 15 years old. He was a very poor student, and there was signs that he was on the police radar and that he was bound for trouble, but he was also a very smart and manipulative kid. And so once he sort of became Spoda's witness, unlike his pals who also became Spoda's witnesses in these cases, you know, those guys kind of wanted nothing more to do with cops or prosecutors other than what they had to do, you know, to get out from under some case of their face. But Jimmy had a fascination with the homicide squad and with the top prosecutors of Suffolk County. And as you mentioned, his father and his grandfather were both NYPD. And so he starts hanging around the offices, and he almost becomes like Tom Spoda's work son, this strange sight of this teenager hanging around homicide office. And he kind of becomes indispensable to those offices.
You talk, it's not a humorous book, but you talk about that through Spoda, they're workshopping the stories for the grand jury. Found that humorous in that, but it is telling that that's what you called the progression of the story that Jimmy Burke was telling for on behalf of Spoda, Thomas Spoda.
Yeah, well, one of my favorite gets as a reporter, you know, doing this book was a video that I got from 1981, where it was Spoda seated at a desk, sort of having the various teenage witnesses that had become the glue in this case come in and talk about how Peter Carterero and his brother and his and friends had how they were implicated in statements made to these kids. And it was really interesting watching. And one of them was Jimmy Burke. And he comes in and he meets Tom Spoda. And it's, and this interaction is filmed by somebody filming on behalf of the DA's office. And it's really interesting watching these interactions, particularly with Jimmy Burke. His story doesn't match what he later says on the stand. And then you sort of see, you know, in later times when Burke is, makes other testimony in the case, sometimes years later, the testimony keeps shifting. And so the way that I saw that video was they were still workshopping what he was going to say. And, you know, essentially what Burke did say and what he said, you know, in various trials, because, you know, there were four defendants, was exactly what the prosecutor's office needed him to say. And as I write, you know, that later was directly rewarded by the prosecutor's office.
So you outline how they try to guarantee fill in the holes. Thomas Spoda and his minions try to plug up the holes and use their resources. You talk about someone named a Locke and another guy named Thorpe in prison. So tell us about this plan and how they get these guys further involved and further incriminated in these crimes.
Right. So in some jurisdictions, they, you know, prosecutors try to stay away from jailhouse witnesses because they are inherently, you know, not to be believed because one, they're people in the jailhouse. They're people that have interactions with the criminal world and are, you know, in all likelihood criminals themselves, which is why they're in jail. And two, they have something to work out from under. You know, they're in jail. They can directly benefit from prosecutors and police liking their story that they have to tell. But in Suffolk County, that's just not the case. At least around at this time, they, you know, jailhouse snitching was so popular that there would be sort of auditions where the inmates would get before a detective and say what is, especially in a high profile case where the detectives and prosecutors were seeking informants, they would tell a story about what that inmate told them while in the jailhouse with them. And the detectives would typically pick the person whose story they liked the best. And so that sort of happened in this case, you know, the stuff that couldn't be covered by the needs that couldn't be handled by Burke and by other teenage witnesses along with him were handled by a couple of very dubious jailhouse witnesses. And, you know, I guess the one problem is how do you get a jailhouse witness to inform on somebody who's not in jail? Which was a problem in this case because these kids, once they were indicted, they were out on bail quickly and didn't spend any time in jail. And so you have these cases that popped up where the kids were caught, you know, with low-level burglaries, which were no doubt dumb on their part. Like, for example, in one of the cases, one of the defendants was caught in having stolen a set of walkie-talkies from his high school. And the informants who sort of set him up in that case, one of them was Jimmy Burke. And the other one was another teenage witness who was known as an informant in Smithtown. So by those means, they get these kids in the jailhouses. And then from there, it's sort of open game for hardened criminals who kind of, first of all, they get the newspapers in there. So they read about the high profile cases and then they know how to spin the facts for the cops. And so, you know, one pair of these jailhouse inmates became the key witnesses for one of the defendants. And they, you know, the story was again, extremely convenient. One of the jailhouse witnesses said that one of the defendants basically spilled his whole saga, which pretty much matched what the police had said about killing John Pius, and, you know, including complete dialogue from all the players. And this was a witness who had a documented drug addiction problem, and he had received a deal in return for his testimony. And so, you know, basically through this like patchwork method, typically relying on witnesses who had something to gain from their testimony, the prosecutors, you know, built convictions against these four kids. There was no actual physical evidence tying them to the murder of John Pius.
Yeah. So you talk about the convictions of all of these young men, the Cordereros and the brothers, and also eventually Tom Ryan. And you say the only person that Burke was not involved with in decimating with his testimony was Tom Ryan. And right after that, you write that there was a reversal of fortune for Jimmy Burke, in that those convictions for his DUI were helped by law enforcement. Tell us how his fortune changed and what happened to those charges and how his life seemed to be turned around by this event.
Sure. And if I could just emphasize, you know, during his testimony against these various defendants, the inconsistencies were blatant. For example, in one trial where he's testifying against one defendant, a buddy of his, he might say that person said, you know, a incriminating statement at a certain place on, you know, in Smithtown, near high school bleachers. And then in his testimony against another one of the defendants, he might say that guy said the exact same thing in the exact same place at the same time of year. And so it was almost like he was just, you know, taking stock testimony that was incriminating and it helped get a conviction in one case, putting it in the mouth of the other. So, you know, he was a very useful witness, you know, in the early years of this case, and he had gotten a DUI and then not shown up in court to address it. And then there had been a bench warrant made out to his for his arrest. This became an issue when he applied to become a police officer with the NYPD. And, you know, there was a lot of other reasons why he would have been unqualified, including, you know, documented drug use and the fact that, his friends were basically a crew of the most troubled kids in Smithtown, and by his own word, were also, you know, convicted murderers. So he had his black marks against him in applying to become a cop. The main one, you know, from a sort of strictly procedural point of view of the vetting policies of a police department, was the idea that he had not shown up to court to deal with this bench warrant. So one of the prosecutors in the Pius case at that time wrote on a Suffolk County DA stationery, sent it to NYPD, and said, essentially, excuse Burke having incurred a bench warrant. The reason why was because he was supposed to be in Suffolk County testifying in a major case. And so he couldn't be in the neighboring county, Nassau County, to address his DUI. And that's why he had a bench warrant. And the NYPD accepted that. And I don't think that they fact checked it, because, you know, I did, just using transcripts of the Pius case, which clearly the Pius prosecutor was implying that that was the case that Burke was testifying in. And there's to testify in court the day that he incurred the bench warrant. Not only that, but at one point he was actually asked in court, why did you get this bench warrant, by a defense attorney? And he said, I had a roofing job to do that day. So he contradicted the prosecutor's version of events. And, you know, I tried to ask the prosecutor, who's now a prominent defense attorney in Suffolk County, about that letter, and he refused to answer any questions about it. So, you know, I think I have no reason to think anything other than the DA's office, you know, lied in order to reward Burke for his dubious testimony. And in doing so, they made sure that he was not denied a career as a police officer. And, you know, sort of from there, the rest is history as far as Jimmy Burke is concerned.
Now we're going to get into the retrials, but at the time, what were the sentences for the four boys, Ryan, Rob Brenzik, and the Mike and Peter Cortereiro?
Yeah, Cordero is a tough one. Between 9 and 25 years to life. So all of them had life sentences. Some of them could have been paroled earlier. It was all sort of up to the parole board as far as how much time they would end up serving.
Now, you talk about the rise and ascent of Jimmy Burke after this. So he's with the NYPD, his dream. Tell us about the ascent and the rise. And also, there are some troubling developments like Judge Stuart Nam and investigations on the rise as well at the same time. Tell us what happens.
So he puts in a year in the NYPD, somewhat typical. Suffolk County PD is today the highest paid police force in the country. And back then it was also highly paid. And so the goal of many cops was to get out there. So he succeeds in doing so. He does a year in NYPD and then he's able to put in his papers and get a job instead in the Suffolk PD. And so, you know, Suffolk County is a really interesting territory because it's a large amount of cops from all over Long Island and also from New York City live in Suffolk County. And so it's sort of like a cop-controlled block, including, you know, the political forces are very much beholden to police. And so one defense attorney described it as was, for example, homicide detectives out there were the princes of the county and that they could do anything that they wanted. And so, you know, you sort of see that in the Pius case and the way that the detectives behaved. And that wasn't an isolated incident. In basically every homicide case, that is what they sought to do, is get a confession. And typically it came with allegations that they had brutalized their suspect and in often creative ways. You know, one of their favorite methods was using a phone book, putting a phone book on a suspect's head and then beating his head with the phone book so that there's no visible marks left in a mugshot. And sometimes this was alleged. Other times, you know, this abuse was proven. You know, the issue with Suffolk County is it's a place where, you know, as I said, the cops run the politics. The cops control sort of every layer of it. And so you had a problem arise when Burke was a young cop, which was not related to Burke, but was sort of telling about the way that his career went from there, which was a judge started growing suspicious of the testimony in his court. And his name was Stuart Nam. And among the cases, the high profile cases that had come before his court were two of the Pius cases. And in those cases, he had made clear that he believed that he agreed with the jury when they convicted those defendants and he sentenced them to 25 to life. But in following cases, sort of in the next couple of years to come, as he later wrote in a memoir, his understanding of the nefariousness of Suffolk County sort of became more clear to him. And he started to believe that prosecutors and detectives were perjuring themselves in murder cases. And he complained to the governor. And there was a pretty wide-ranging state investigation that took place of Suffolk County. One of the characters who were investigated was Tom Spoda. And Tom Spoda was investigated for being involved in a alleged scheme in which cops would be paid $100 to refer refer DUI clients to a private law firm, which is illegal. He denied doing it. So you have this kind of wide-ranging investigation. You know, when it's actually published years later, it's really scathing. And it, you know, basically it implicates the top leaders of the Suffolk County DA's office and the PD for overseeing a culture of corruption and incompetence in which, you know, homicide cases were botched. In the narcotics squad, the cops were getting high off of their own supply. There was framing of defendants. Just pretty horrible stuff, bluntly stated by this very esteemed state commission. And so you sort of think, this might clean up the place. But in fact, you know, Suffolk County is resilient. And it didn't clean up the place. And most of the people, the sort of law enforcement honchos who were named in the report, including Tom Spoda, just continued to become more powerful people. And so that's sort of the environment where Burke was a young cop, and that he later sort of learned to navigate those rungs of power very well.
Let's use this, Gus, as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. Certain people just make my life so much easier. I don't know what I'd do without them, like my podcast engineer, Evan, who takes care of all the things technical so I can concentrate just on the interviews. It's like if you own a growing business and need to hire. ZipRecruiter makes hiring so much easier because they do the work for you. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter uses powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. You can easily review these recommended candidates and invite your top choices to apply. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. In fact, the hardest thing you have to do is to remember our special URL, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's where you can go to try ZipRecruiter for free. Once again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, we were talking about Jimmy Burke and Thomas Spoda and them eventually avoiding any kind of prosecution. And you detail in the book the punishment for Judge Nam by the police community, basically, law enforcement community, Burke and his friends. Well, let's talk about the retrial of these poor 4 once were teens, well, now are adults. What happens with their retrial bids, parole? Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. So all 4 boys were initially convicted. Their cases were then thrown out. Their convictions were then thrown out on appeal. And for a variety of reasons, one of them being that the, you know, their convictions relied on the confession, which was found to be coerced.
Right.
And so one of the boys, Peter Carterero, the one whose confession sort of led to all of it, was never retried. And the other 3 sort of went through this long odyssey, much of it reliant on Jimmy Burke's testimony of convictions, successful appeals, reconvictions. And so, you know, for example, one of the cases, that of Rob Brinzig, after his case was overturned, he was getting ready to go to trial again. And, you know, he had some good news in that his case was transferred to Brooklyn from Suffolk County. So his lawyer was excited because, you know, a Brooklyn jury is very different from a Suffolk County jury. And he was offered a deal that his lawyer said would be malpractice to turn down, even though his lawyer maintains and Rob himself maintains that he was wrongfully convicted. It was sort of an unheard of deal if you're familiar with criminal procedure, in which one, Brinzig wouldn't have to implicate anybody else. He could testify as to the facts very vaguely, and he would essentially get what was advertised as time served. And so he ended up pleading guilty. And, you know, another of his co-defendants, Tom Ryan, didn't want to do that. And he took it back to trial, and he was convicted again on the word of an ex-girlfriend, one of these informants from Smithtown, and who said that he had made a pseudo confession to her. And then another, Michael Carterero, Peter's brother, was convicted largely on the testimony of James Burke. And this again was one of these cases of sort of shifting testimony by Burke. And, you know, their cases, that saga sort of continued for them, where Ryan, after Ryan's case was again, conviction was again overturned, he was offered a similar deal to Brinzig, where it was essentially time served, or you can take your chances and perhaps face another life sentence. And by then, Ryan, you got to remember, these guys were teenagers when this happened. The youngest was 14, which is Mike Cordero. You know, the oldest was 60. And so by then, they're, you know, by the time this saga reaches this point, they're middle-aged men. And so Tom Ryan, you know, who had already spent more than 2 decades in prison, decided that he couldn't risk it. And he, he also took a plea deal. And Mike Cordero eventually was paroled. And so, you know, at one point in this saga, that same state investigative commission that Judge Nam had sort of sicked on Suffolk County, they opined about the idea that this extremely favorable plea deal was offered to Rob Brinzik with all of these odd tripwires, including even that, like, John Pius's family couldn't sue him. So, you know, stuff that sort of mixed civil with criminal, and just stuff you don't really see in plea deals. They said essentially it was a completely inappropriate use of prosecutors' power, and that it was essentially more concerned with PR than justice, and sort of that's sort of how these cases unraveled, which the Suffolk County DA's office, you know, through various, at this point, various DAs, various prosecutors, Tom Sport is always kind of a constant, though. They were, you know, clinging to these convictions, and no matter if the, you know, the plea deal, the facts of the plea deals, or the in which the defendant sort of stated what happened, if those circumstances didn't make sense with each other, that didn't matter. And even if the you know, they were basically offering time served to these guys, what really mattered was the idea that their convictions were upheld. And to me, that sort of shows the importance of James Burke and what he wrote, you know, in the beginning of his career, was the idea that he was the glue to these cases. And for that reason, he was very important.
Now we go to the fall down of Jimmy Burke. And part of that is a woman that he meets named Loretta, a prostitute and a known heroin and cocaine dealer, as you write. And then they fall in love. This love affair, many people hear about it. There's rumors abound. And so investigators do hear about this as well. Tell us a little bit about this relationship and the fallout from it.
Sure. So, you know, as a young beat cop in one of the toughest precincts in Suffolk County, you know, he starts this romance with a sex worker named Loretta Rickenbacker, basically one of the more notorious kind of creatures of the street in Suffolk County. Everyone in Burke's precinct knew about her, except for apparently him, because when Internal Affairs hears about this they're told about it by other sex workers. And so they start investigating Jimmy Burke. And when they drag Jimmy Burke into an interrogation room and ask him about it, and, you know, that Burke is accompanied by union lawyers, he says for one that he was unaware of Rickenbacker's criminal history, even though he was a street cop specializing in narcotics in the same precinct. But, you know, there's a lot that sort of, that essentially gets swept under the rug in that investigation. One was the idea that Burke was doing drugs with Rickenbacker, which she told me he was, but she told the IAB cops, the Internal Affairs Bureau cops, that he wasn't. And so sort of via that means, and mostly because he has this rabbi in Tom Spoda, who's at various stages, he's a top detectives association attorney, and at one point, the DA, the district attorney. Burke is protected. And so, you know, his career is he never really faces serious consequences for major internal affairs investigations. And so he continues his rise unabated. There's always kind of this secret with his career, which is that he had this kind of very embarrassing internal affairs past involving his romance with a sex worker. And because of New York laws at the time, all internal affairs records were confidential. So it's sort of like there's rumors about it, and it's clearly something he's embarrassed, but it doesn't come out until much later.
Tell us about, as we talked about in the introduction, about this fateful event where a couple thieves are jiggling doors, they're down on their luck, they're junkies and they're thieves, and they break into Jimmy Burke's vehicle. What do they run away with and what do they find?
So they pull out of his unmarked police truck a duffel bag. And there's one sort of main character here among these two thieves, which is, his name is Christopher Loeb. And he pulls out of the duffel bag, he pulls out sex toys and pornography, and other sort of sexual implements. And at this point, Burke has risen all the way up to the top of one of the largest police departments in the country. He's chief of department. He's been that for less than a year. But he now controls, you know, elite units. And so he has some of these elite cops put on the case of the guy who stole his duff bag. And so at one point he joins three of those detectives in an interrogation room, and all four of them slap around Chris Loeb, and Burke gives Loeb the most vicious beating. And, you know, you have a precinct cops who witnessed it. You also have a bunch of cops at Loeb's house who also witnessed a Burke at his house, which is not protocol. And so from there, this massive cover up ensues, because the feds learn about the beating and start poking around. And you sort of see like an instinctive reaction by cops ranging from, you know, lowly highway patrol to, you know, top lieutenants, also in the prosecutor's office, the DA himself, Tom Spoda, a top prosecution prosecutor, Chris McPartland, and other prosecutors. They all sort of join ranks to lie. They lie in grand juries. They lie in, they lie to federal agents. And basically they just cover up the fact that Burke beat up Chris Loeb. And it's this long cover up that spans years and leads to this point in the book. I sort of think of it as like, you know, the mob movie Goodfellas, in which all of these characters are, you know, kind of breaking down from the paranoia. And yet they keep their stories. It's extremely hard to make these cops and prosecutors move off their lies and sort of give up James Burke and tell the truth about what they saw.
It's interesting too, that Bag, when you talk about the dildos, is that he is able somehow to come in and take that bag away and bring it, like you say, to his home, so that there is no inventory of what was in that bag. So, but there is a report of later, of course, no eyewitness to what was actually in the bag, but there is a police report later that says there were certain items in that bag, wasn't there?
Yeah, and some cops, you know, once this whole thing unravels, cops sort of started to tell the truth to the feds, and so they confirmed that there was dildos that they hid, and that there was also pornography. And the big question is, what kind of pornography? At one point, it's alleged that Burke had child pornography in his bag. The feds don't believe that. And I think pretty compellingly, well, you know, one of the things they say is child pornographers typically don't label their contraband with, you know, a cover that lets you know it's child pornography. Mm-hmm. Either way, Burke, you know, had pornography in his bag. And yeah, that was one of the most stunning things to me, was just how quickly, it was not even spoken among the cops who, for example, were at Loeb's house. You know, one of them sees a pill jar of Viagra, throws it in the garbage immediately. You know, the dildos, they're gone. All this stuff sort of vaporizes. And it's like just an unspoken cover-up, with not even covering up a crime, just some slightly embarrassing, you know, sort of invoice of what was in the duffel bag that probably would have just been on some police reports that they would have never released publicly anyways, right? And so to me, it said a lot about this, you know, certain corners of police culture where the cover-up is like muscle memory.
You also talk about, in keeping with that support that you're talking about, is that Burke has some powerful supporters along the way, like Commissioner Kieran. But at the same time, there's people that he, like Paddy Cuff, who laughed in Burke's face at one time. There are people coming back to the prosecution of Jimmy Burke from his past, isn't it?
Yeah. So you see, you know, you sort of see throughout Burke's trajectory, there are cops at the sort of mid-level who try to warn those at the top. Like, this guy is not an appropriate candidate to rise up the ranks of this department. One of them was Paddy Cuff, who was the internal affairs investigator, one of them who handled the Loretta Rickenbacker investigation. And as you said, during Burke's interrogation, when Burke said he had a sterling reputation in the police department, Cuff, thinking about some of the more graphic allegations against them involving Loretta Rickenbacker, involving sex in their sector car, in his sector car, laughed in his face, and Burke never forgot that. So, you know, that's an example of one of the characters who kind of never kind of bowed to Burke. And another is a top MS-13 detective named John Oliva, who Burke had a vendetta against and at one point removed him from a task force where he was investigating MS-13 murders. Also, a couple of detectives who sent an anonymous letter to top officials in Suffolk County, explicitly warning them that Burke was not cut out to be chief of department, and listing the allegations against him, most of which turned out to be completely accurate and were ignored by top people in the county, including the county executive, who's the top elected official, who read the letter and completely disregarded it because at that point he was sort of beholden to James Burke. So you see, you know, these cops who are trying to do the right thing. I think they were for the most part just concerned that the department was going to completely embarrass itself by having this guy at its helm, which, you know, was prophetic and true. And they are kind of, you know, not only ignored, but their careers get destroyed by Burke and others who are sort of in Burke's thrall for trying to speak up against them.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now let's talk about his fall. What finally and who finally brings him down and how? And all of the people that go down with him.
So Burke had a right-hand man. His name was James Hickey. Hickey was the lieutenant of the Criminal Intelligence Unit, which was an elite squad within Suffolk County PD. And this was sort of the squad that had access to all sorts of intel on both criminals and political characters. And they were kind of Burke's glorified goon squad. And so Hickey becomes the middleman, which is how he later described it, in the cover-up, where he puts extreme pressure on the detectives who are also involved in the low beating to not talk to the feds. And initially that works. The feds, you know, have a lengthy investigation. They try to speak to witnesses. And they like sort of blanket Suffolk County and subpoenas. And everyone, all these cops stick to their lies. And so the federal investigation is closed. The problem is Burke is sort of drunk on power at this point. And so he orders a wiretap on one of his enemies, John Oliva. And he wanted to see if Oliva was a source for embarrassing stories that were coming out in Newsday. One about Burke's relationship with Loretta Rickenbacker. And he ultimately has Oliva arrested on trumped up charges. The problem is Oliva was, as I said, he was in a federal task force investigating MS-13 before Burke sort of removed him from that. And so the feds liked Oliva. The federal government liked Oliva. And so when they learned that that was happening, that there was this trumped up wiretap where Burke was listening to conversations that Oliva was having, including with federal agents, that seemed to be the last straw. And they basically, you know, seemed to finally take notice this county was essentially, county law enforcement was essentially being run by organized criminals. And so they started using methods that were more serious than they had before, including promising people immunity if they were to testify. So you ultimately have detectives who start to get pulled over to the federal side. And it's, you know, like any mob movie, really, right? Once you lose one, then the others are all sort of scrambling because they know they're either going down or they got to get on the Fed side. And so the guy who really became, you know, the Sammy the Bull Gravano in this case was Jim Hickey, who was Burke's right hand. And so he had been in all these rooms with Burke and the DA and top corruption prosecutors explicitly discussing how they were going to cover up this crime, you know, with full knowledge that they were obstructing justice.
Mm-hmm.
And Hickey, who suffers multiple sort of like breakdowns, you know, in the narrative of the book, including one where he sees giant lizards driving a Cadillac. He's suffering this, going through these crazy mental episodes. He ultimately becomes the chief witness, and the federal unraveling leads to Burke's mentor, Tom Spoda, also being convicted of federal crimes and going to federal prison, as does Burke himself.
And what of any kind of reform of Suffolk County as a result of this?
You know, I think that remains to be seen. Like I've sort of described before, there's been efforts to sort of reform Suffolk County before that have looked pretty formidable, and that didn't actually happen. So I think it might be naive to think, you know, because Burke and his cronies were removed, that it'll happen this time. But you know, I think that remains to be seen.
Now, what of the, you know, this investigation ultimately obviously looks at the Johnny Pius case and what had happened from that. As a result of them obviously looking at that, what did they do or conclude?
Well, I really appreciate, you know, like during this interview, the sort of focus on the Pius case, because I think what sometimes gets lost in this is the idea that there's four boys, now men, who lost a big chunk of their lives due to testimony from convicted liars now, right? Jimmy Burke and Tom Spoda was the prosecutor.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I know the defense at one point, you know, pulled the file, got all the records from the DA's office concerning the Pius case. They at least looked into it, but I think they were only looking into it basically to understand Burke's relationship to Spoda. I don't think that they actually examined the case, unfortunately. And so, you know, you have these three of them are still technically convicted murderers. And, you know, the Suffolk County has in recent years sort of had a reckoning in which the DA's office has reexamined some convictions that were very similar, made by the homicide squad around the same time, often involving, you know, people separated from their lawyers or families. And there's one where a guy was he was exonerated, and his, you know, he was around the same age as these four boys. So to me, you know, this is a case that I think cries out for reexamination. And so in my reporting, I found multiple sort of, you know, for lack of a better word, suspects, or at least people of interest, that were completely disregarded by the detectives because they had at that point seized on these four boys, and it would be after getting a confession out of one of them, you know, they weren't eager to look at another suspect. And so I did a lot of reporting on the Pius case. But I, you know, there's a limit that, for example, Burke's fellow witnesses wouldn't speak to me, to a man, you know, around six people who were involved in this prosecution, none of them would say anything, even though it's been decades later, which to me seemed notable. You know, as a reporter, typically you'll get one or two people that are willing to talk. And it made me wonder why don't anyone want to talk about their testimony in this case? And so people like that, who I think the DA's office could probably get to talk a lot easier than I could. And so, you know, I would love to see the Suffolk County law enforcement establishment sort of acknowledge, hey, this case was built on a tainted foundation. And, you know, these guys may be out of prison, but, you know, they deserve to at least have it reexamined. Heck, John Pius, murdered in 1979, deserves to have an actual, you know, investigation, as much as can be done at this point, as to who killed him. So that's what I have to say.
With this book, are you saying that you have a bigger hope for this book other than the story being completely told? Do you have a bigger hope for this book and its effect?
Sure. I mean, you know, this book is a journalistic enterprise where I essentially tried to report all that I could. But I think, you know, in getting very deep into the Pius case, it seemed to me that there was no evidence. You know, perhaps those four boys that were convicted, maybe they did it, but there's no evidence that they did, any more so than there is any other you know, random boy in Smithtown who might have been interrogated. So, I think that you know, one of the goals that sort of developed as a writing it was a hope that the authorities in Suffolk County might sort of take the findings in the book and use them to sort of re-examine what happened in the Pius case.
How disturbing, as you can conclude, was this whole story in how difficult it was to bring these bad cops and their behavior to light and to justice?
It wasn't easy, right? I mean, there's a very strong tendency towards secrecy by the police and by prosecutors. And so kind of at every juncture, you know, you're sort of blocked. And then, you know, one example is not being able to see internal affairs records. Another is one that you might even think would, you know, is a good policy, which is in New York. If somebody is acquitted at trial, all of their court records are sealed. But, you know, I came across cases where Jimmy Burke was the main witness and there were allegations that he lied during court, but the court records are sealed because it resulted in an acquittal. So you sort of have this kind of very black box of a justice system and the guys who run it. So, you know, that was difficult. It was also difficult to get people to talk initially. Mm-hmm. But I think once it was probably similar to what the feds felt, right? One sort of key player in this, one of the detectives spoke to me. I think word spread that, hey, I'm not going to be the only one talking to this guy. And so I ended up getting a lot more interviews than I would have thought. But, you know, I think it's everything that occurred in this book only occurred because of the secrecy that surrounds this culture of policing. And so that was definitely took some time to pierce.
Absolutely. I want to thank you so much, Gus Garcia Roberts, for coming on and talking about your new book, Jimmy the King: Murder, Vice, and the Reign of a Dirty Cop. For those that might want to check out, contact you about further information about this, potentially tell us about your Twitter connection.
Sure. Come see me on Twitter at G Garcia Roberts. So that's GGARCIARoberts. And please reach out.
Thank you so much. Jimmy the King: Murder, Vice, and the Reign of a Dirty Cop. Thank you so much, Gus Garcia Roberts. You have a great evening. Thank you.
This was wonderful. Thank you. Bye.
Good night.